Now to some developments in the upper house. Not the Australian upper house, the Senate, which was actually the first in the world to be directly elected, but in the UK, where, of course, the upper house is the House of Lords, which dates back to the 14th century. In 1999, the Blair Labor government removed the right of most hereditary lords to sit in Parliament, but a compromise meant that 92 hereditary peers remained. So today, most of the about 800 peers in the House of Lords are life peers. But in March, a new act was passed by both Houses of Parliament to end the right of those remaining 92 hereditary peers to sit in the House of Lords. And one of the people affected by that change is our next guest. The Lord Lucas is the 12th Baron Lucas and 8th Lord Dingwall, and by virtue of those hereditary titles, he's been a member of the House of Lords since 1992. The Lord Lucas's name is Ralph Matthew Lucas, and I'm very pleased to say he joins us now on Sunday Extra. Lord Lucas, welcome.
Good morning.
Lord Lucas, how do you feel about the passage of this act that removes your right to sit in the House of Lords?
Well, when I joined the House of Lords in 1992, just after my mother had died, I was convinced that Neil Kinnock was going to win the election. He had promised that he was going to abolish the House of Lords, so I thought I might be in there for a few months. Let's take the chance. So I've been constantly astonished to stay in there.
Right, so you regard yourself as having like a few decades of bonus time.
But no, it's obviously right that the hereditary peerage should go.
Okay. Did you vote on the bill?
I voted on various amendments to the bill, but we never opposed the bill as a whole.
Okay, so the House of Lords, it was not a controversial change through the House, although, of course, the majority are life peers now.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of people were sad about it because of something about keeping a historical connection, and I could see that aspect of things. But there was a lot of argument about what the House of Lords should look like in the future, and very little about let's keep the hereditary peers. There were one or two people who felt that way, but not many.
Going back to this 1999 reform and the exception for the 90-odd hereditary peers, what was the rationale for that exception, and how was it that you came to be within the lucky 92?
Well, the rationale was that at that stage, there was a big hereditary majority in the House of Lords. And if we had felt upset about the way we were being treated, we might well have derailed the first year of the Labour government's legislation. And I think they quite rightly felt that doing a deal was a good way of getting around that. As soon as we felt that there were some people we cared about who might survive, then really none of us wanted to disrupt that process. We always all wanted that to go through. And the 92 was, well, we had an election, and the election was by party groups, and the Conservatives were allowed 42, if I remember. And very few people have 42 friends in an organization. So people put their friends first, but then we're looking around for people who've been active. And I had been very active in my few years in the House of Lords, and I suspect I got picked up because of that.
And when you say a vote, this was a vote of the Lords as to who the 92 should be?
Should be, yes. So all the Conservative peers voted for who they wanted to be their 42. And you had to have 42 votes. You couldn't leave any out. So people had to really stretch. I remember finding it quite difficult to compile the second half of my 42.
Well, you clearly got them, though. From your perspective, how did the House of Lords change after the 1999 reforms?
Well, it's always been quite slow. I mean, all the life peers who were there had been used to a house that was largely hereditary. And we've been changing since then into a house which is now going to be totally life peers. And I think it has become more political. It has become less forgiving. People are much more there for the feeling that they deserve to be there. And so they want to be noticed. They want just to do the things that interest them. there's less of a feeling of service to the House of a whole. But no, this is, there are obviously a huge number of exceptions to that. But in general, I think the place is in the process of slowly falling apart.
Right. On Sunday Extra, we are speaking with the Lord Lucas, the 12th Baron Lucas and 8th Lord Dingwall, who is one of the 92 remaining hereditary peers whose right to sit in the House of Lords is soon to end. Although I must ask you, Lord Lucas, is it about to end? Because I have read that perhaps in the tradition of the 1999 exception, there may be one last compromise. The BBC's reporting what one outgoing peer has described as the hereditary lifeboat, that there might be some hereditary peers converted into life peers as part of a deal. Are you aware of that, and are you going to be in the lifeboat?
Well, I think the principle is the same as on the Titanic. It's women and children first. While there aren't any women in contention, there are definitely a lot of very good younger hereditary peers, and I hope they're the ones that get chosen.
So there will be some sort of deal that will allow those people to remain.
I hope so. I hope that will go through. I hope they'll choose the young ones, because there's some very good young peers who have clearly settled down to making this the contribution they make to the country.
Mm. Ultimately, though, those lords will be selected by the Prime Minister. Is that right?
The formality is that they have to be offered a peerage by the Prime Minister, but on the recommendation of the Leader of the Opposition for the Conservatives, and in some other form for the crossbenchers.
You mentioned that the focus is now moving to how the House of Lords will look and will operate in the future. How is the rest of the House of Lords appointed these days?
Well, it's appointed by the Prime Minister. The peers on the opposition benches are appointed by the Prime Minister on the recommendation of the leader of their party. So it's very much the choice of the party leader. I remember when Blair first became leader of the opposition, he appointed a very large number of very good Labour peers, people he admired, who he thought intelligent, who he thought would really contribute. Then when he got into government, he found that these people didn't always agree with him and do what he said. Gradually, the proportion of people who are there because they've given money, or there because they're loyalists, or there because they've achieved something and just want that celebrated, has increased over the number of peers who are really there to do a serious job of work. And in the end, that I think is going to prove fatal.
Mm. So is there any numerical limit on the number of life peers that can be appointed? And if they're appointed in a partisan way, doesn't that make it very easy to stack the House of Lords?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And that's the danger. There's no quality control beyond something very minimal. There's no rule that says if you're appointed, you have to contribute. And if the Prime Minister wants control of the House of Lords, he or she just has to carry on appointing till they've got a majority.
Hmm.
By and large, they haven't done that to date, but it's always open.
Fascinating. Looking back on your very long and, as you said, much longer than expected tenure as a voting member of the House of Lords, Lord Lucas, what's the contribution that you're most proud of as a legislator?
I think in the general pattern of things, just little things like finding to think of one example, it's the whole area of knife crime is difficult, but there are knives that we want kept. If your grandfather came back from the Second World War with a German commando dagger, you don't want him to have to surrender that. It's most unlikely to be used in a crime. So finding people who could advocate for historic knives, who the civil servants would trust, who could form a long-term relationship with the Home Office team so that the legislation became one that, yes, protected the public, but also kept our history alive. So just little things like that, little human things of people out there who didn't have access to Parliament, who I've tried to connect with Parliament, and small changes to law, but mostly working, just getting the government to think through what they're doing. Most of the time failing and being disappointed, but it's the nature of things.
Now, you do seem very zen, Lord Lucas, with the change. Given that your title is hereditary, though, I suppose I should ask, how does your son feel about these changes?
I think he's entirely relaxed about it. He never expected to be involved. He's not shown any wish to be involved.
I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about your hereditary title or titles.
I've got two titles, Lord Lucas of Crowdwall and Lord Dingwall. Lord Dingwall is the oldest, was James I's and VI's first boyfriend, because James was thoroughly bisexual all his life. But when he came south from Scotland, he brought with him a young lad called Richard Preston, who had been his page since the age of 7, and made him Lord Dingwall, which was a title that was going spare at the time. There was no connection with it, no money. And Lord Dingwall was a very flamboyant, wild character, very fond of tournaments, turned up at one riding on a full-size imitation elephant. So a lot of expenditure and no income, but so he lived a fairly rackety life. But he made his money by betraying Catholics in a days when if you found someone who was still practicing the Catholic religion, the state confiscated all their assets and the person who betrayed them got a third of it. Right. So this was that was his principal income.
Right. Well, Lord Lucas, clearly you've inherited the title, but I hope you haven't inherited too many of the original Lord Dingwall's practices.
No, and that Lord Lucas of Crowdwall was a title given in honour of the last cavalry commander for Charles I, who was someone called Sir Charles Lucas, and a very fine soldier. But he was executed at the end of the Civil War, and so nothing would have remained of that except his younger sister married the Duke of Newcastle, who was a very rich man. And so when Charles II came back, and as was his habit, ran out of money fairly frequently, Margaret Lucas was able to buy a peerage in honour of her brother. And that had to go to a girl because all the men had been killed fighting. So the first holder was Mary Lucas.
Is that rare to have a peerage where the first holder is female?
I think it's very rare for the first holder to be female. And it's pretty rare in England for the titles to go down through the female line. I mean, the monarchy's been able to do it for a long time, but mostly the English titles go to males only, which is why they die out so often.
Well, what a fascinating lineage your titles come with. I noticed another quirk of the House of Lords, Lord Lucas, is that there's also the spiritual lords. We've been talking about the temporal lords. So there's bishops who retain seats in the House of Lords. Is that a matter which is considered something that might also be reformed to reflect a changed Great Britain these days, or is that something that's continuing without controversy?
We certainly had some arguments about it when the bill was going through, but I think there's a strong feeling that we remain at root a Christian country, and having a voice for that in Parliament works really quite well. I mean, there's not that many of them. They can't vote anything else down, but they're always worth listening to.
Right. So the bishops don't have a balance of power, but still, yep, in your view, are making a valuable contribution. So have you sat for the last time in the House of Lords, Lord Lucas, or will you get another chance before I suppose I shouldn't say the guillotine falls, but before your right to sit in the House of Lords formally ends?
I think this is more of the nature of defenestration than guillotine. Being chucked out. No, I've got about a week and a half to go.
And do you have any plans for your final sitting?
Absolutely not in terms of flamboyance or misbehaviour. No, I think it's an institution I've been very honoured to be part of for a long time, and I've no way I want to disrespect it on my last day.
Well, Lord Lucas, you've been a credit to the House of Lords in your generosity speaking with us today. Thank you so much for joining us on Sunday Extra.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
That is the Lord Lucas, Ralph Matthew Lucas, the 12th Baron Lucas, and the 8th Lord Dingwall, whose time as a member of the House of Lords goes back to 1992, but will be ending at the end of this parliamentary session.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.